session number 27075, reel 15.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 15. You were just telling me about the space that you occupied on Furious's flight deck.
Yes, that's right. It's a little open square on the front port side of the flight deck with some basic equipment in it. And this we discovered was where the commander flying would position himself with his staff while flying operations were taking place. But as far as we knew, there weren't any flying operations planned for us at that time because the Hurricanes were all down below in their crates, or at least they're being taken out of their crates and assembled to be flown off to who knows where. So we enjoyed ourselves quite considerably. It was another world altogether for us to be in a big naval vessel surrounded by cruisers and destroyers, all chugging through quite fair seas, a little bit choppy, but nothing too much. And this went on for two or three days. And I think at this point we were informed that we were going to Gibraltar. But I think that was all.
While you were on board, where did you sleep?
Oh, we had cabins. Some of the officers, in fact, some of the ship's officers had moved out to give us their cabins. I don't know where they went. But we had their nice little cabins, which were very comfortable. Cramped, but comfortable.
Were there Fleet Air Arm personnel on board?
Now, there is a question. I've always been a bit vague about where the Fleet Air Arm started and finished, to tell you the truth. I know at one time they referred to simply as the Royal Navy Flying Branch, and then they became...
I think they would have been Fleet Air Arm by that stage.
They would have been, would they?
The only reason I was asking, because I thought Furious was quite a small carrier. And obviously with your Hurricanes on board,
yes.
I was wondering if there were actually, if you did come across any Fleet Air Arm, because they may or may not have been on board if you were flying your Hurricanes
off. Yes, that's so. No, I really can't say. I would have thought there would probably be a few. However, the the Rock of Gibraltar rose up in front of us on the 26th of June at about last light, I suppose it was. You could see the rock fairly plainly as we came into Gibraltar Harbour, and as we came in we could see a lot of other naval ships dotted around, but in particular another aircraft carrier. And Furious was taken over and moored ahead of this other carrier, which we could then see was the Ark Royal. And when it was dark, they undid the strings that held the Furious in place and moved her astern, so that her stern was overridden by the Ark's overhang. Now this might sound quite fantastic, but this is what they did. In the meantime, the lifts were bringing these assembled Hurricanes up from the hangars below. They then put very large planks across the gap between the two ships and wheeled the Hurricanes over one by one onto the flight deck of the Ark Royal. You say, well, ridiculous. But it just happened that that's the way those ships were made. And it worked. So we got all the Hurricanes across. We were told to pick up our bags, go down the gangplank, turn left, turn left again, up the ladder, and you'll be in your new quarters. And there we were, inside the Ark. Well, all this, of course, was done to fool the German spies across the bay in Algeciras, who watched every move the Navy made and reported it straight back to Germany. So it was a black night, and before long the engines were running, and off we went. And we went out into the Atlantic for a little while. I can't remember just how long. Anyway, we set off westwards, out into the Atlantic, and then the whole fleet turned around 180 degrees, went back through the straits and headed eastwards. So the next morning we were somewhere in the Med going east. We were probably we'd be off Algeria probably. And that went on all that day, next night, and then the briefing came, and we were told exactly what it was all about, and yes, at first light tomorrow morning, we'll be flying these Hurricanes off the deck, and flying them to Malta. And we were going in two gaggles. Wing Commander Pike was going to lead the first gaggle of 12, I was going to lead the second gaggle of 12. We'd fly at sea level all the way. There'd be 100% strict RT silence. We had overload tanks on, sufficient to give us over 4 hours flying. And we were to land at Tekale, which was the northernmost of the three airfields on Malta.
Would you have had a lead aircraft leading you?
And yes. When the time came, we would be on the in our cockpits, engines running, and a Blenheim would suddenly appear coming up astern, overflying the ship and circling around. And this was to be our lead aircraft. The first formation of 12 flew off. Everybody was intensely interested to see what was going to happen. But at the briefing, the commander flying said, "Now, don't worry about this tiddly little short deck we've asked you to take off from. It's big enough for all of us. You will get off. The ship will be going into a wind of probably 20 knots. She will be steaming at about 30 knots. You've got 50 knots going over the flight deck before you open your throttles. Don't worry about the length of the deck. Whatever you do, don't hit the bloody superstructure. Miss the superstructure. Whatever you do, keep the aircraft straight and you'll be all right." And that's just how it was. Nevertheless, we all watched the wing commander open his throttles and chunter off down the flight deck, and lo and behold, he came unstuck. He didn't even dip down over the bow as we thought he might. Climbed straight away, and the others all followed. I think one or two of them did dip a bit, but not badly. And off they all went, and I thought, well, that's okay, but I've got a bit more flight deck than they had. I'm much better placed. Whereupon the deck control officer waved me forward. And there was my precious little bit of extra deck taken away from me. All with a purpose, of course, because you could keep it straighter. The further forward you were to the superstructure, the straighter you could keep it. And we all got off without any trouble, and formed up in two lots of 12. The Blenheim was there. And off we went. And this went on for quite a few hours.
Were you? Did you have any trepidations about flying over that length of water?
Well, I suppose so. Yes, because we hadn't done a lot of flying over water. Convoy patrols very often up and down, hour after hour. put us over water. Usually we were usually in sight of land. Here we were completely out in the middle of the ocean. Until we got along towards Cape Bon, and we could see the mainland from there. That flight. Okay. Yes, the flight took 4 hours 10 minutes, in fact, from the carrier to Tecali. It's certainly the longest flight I'd ever done. And it all went perfectly smoothly, in fact. The only problem was the ever-present one of the flipping CO2 bottle, which is part of the dinghy pack, and you sit on it. Well, whoever designed that pack should have been made to sit on it for 4 hours, because he put the bottle right where it was the most painful. And it really was quite agonizing. After a couple of hours, you really thought, well, is it? I can't sit on this damn thing any longer. And got another 2 hours to go. But there we are. So we found Malta. We skirted around Cape Bon. All this was at low level, about 100 feet. And we could see the island of Pantorea, which was the Italian fortress island in the Straits of Sicily between Cape Bon and the western corner of Sicily. We fully expected that our presence would be known by now. We had certainly seen an aircraft very low down. It looked like a large French reconnaissance aircraft, but it was some way off. One was tempted to go and see what it was, and if necessary, dispose of it. But we were under strict instructions not to engage any combat at all. We've got to get the aircraft to Malta or whatever. But I couldn't help thinking that we may well have been spotted, and there may well have been fighters waiting for us as we went through Pantelleria. But they didn't see us. They had probably, the Italians weren't up by then. And we pressed on, and then a little sort of leaf appeared to be floating on the water in front of us. And this proved to be Malta. And one was struck immediately by the bareness of it all. It looked like a lump of bare rock with hundreds of buildings scattered all over the place, church domes everywhere, very, very heavily populated. Quite an extraordinary landscape, little tiny fields with stone walls all around them. A sparkling blue sea, only a couple of smallish beaches, and of course the great grand harbour of Valletta with all the ships in there. Quite a wonderful sight. However, we went there for sightseeing and we got the hurricanes down. And they all landed in one piece, all 24 of them. And out we climbed and off to the pilot's dispersal, which turned out to be a very tatty tent. There were no buildings at all. A scrubby bit of area where a few hurricanes were lined up. And the first thing I discovered was that the people there were all my old squadron from North Weald, number 46, who'd gone there lock, stock and barrel, to be followed smartly by number 249, also from North Weald. So it was home from home. And we were allocated to the different squadrons. Some were going off down to Halfar, to 185 Squadron. And I was posted to 249, which was the top-scoring squadron in the Battle of Britain. Wing squadron leader Butch Barton, the squadron commander, Canadian. A brilliant fighter squadron commander. Said very little, got on with the job, did it well. Bowled you out if you got it wrong. gave you a tap on the shoulder if it was all right. And good guy. Damn nearly got killed when his engine stopped just after takeoff one day. The aircraft turned over in one of the little stone-surrounded fields, and he was pinned underneath, and was lucky to get away with it. Johnny Beasley was my flight commander, and Tom Neal, who knocked down 15 in the Battle of Britain, was the other flight commander. I think they, produced some sandwiches or something. And we had these, by now I suppose it was mid-morning. And they said, Johnny Beasley said, "Oh, we'll put you on the state this afternoon." So I was slightly taken aback. And there we were. The system was, we're working in shifts, in point of fact. And A flight, Tom Neal, was he B flight? Anyway, one of the flight, I think it's B flight. They were doing the morning stint, and the other flight, they'd go off at lunchtime, and the other flight would take over for the afternoon stint. So it was really quite a nice arrangement. Well, it meant that literally one was working half time, half a day off every day. So that was quite good. And sure enough, after lunch, Tom and his boys disappeared, and Johnny Beasley's gang arrived, and we were embedded in them. And my name went up that afternoon. Well, this was the beginning of really quite a delightful period in one's flying life. Here we were in a nice warm Mediterranean island, surrounded by one's friends. We had some airplanes to fly. There didn't appear to be too much enemy activity at the time, but we soon discovered that what we'd got going really was a private war between three squadrons of Hurricanes in Malta and the Italian Air Force in Sicily. The point here being that the Luftwaffe had been in Sicily in considerable strength. In the early part of 41, they'd done a lot of damage, and in particular they'd tried to clobber the aircraft carrier Illustrious and hit her several times, but eventually she managed to get away. But they put a tremendous effort into trying to get her. But then the Russian war started, and the Luftwaffe were taken away from Sicily and put up on the Russian front. So all we had to contend with then was the Italian Air Force, which was very much a comic opera affair. They flew, initially they were flying CR-42s, but when we got there, they'd got re-equipped with the Mackie 200, which was in its way quite a useful little single-engine fighter, a radial engine, very lightly armed. I think they'd only got four machine guns. Highly manoeuvrable, and this was what the Italians liked about them, because whenever they got involved in a dogfight, they dive off and do some aerobatics. They'd loop the loop and roll off the top and slow roll and thoroughly enjoy themselves. They weren't too interested in shooting at us unless they got a real chance. But the fact was, of course, the Italians generally were not interested in this war. There were always the few fanatical fascists, of course. They were troublemakers, always had been, always will be. But The rank and file, they just wanted a cosy, happy life in their Mediterranean sunshine and plenty of Chianti and girls. And that suited them fine, that suited them fine. And if they could put on smart uniforms, so much the better. But they didn't bother us very much. They'd come over from time to time. Maybe they put a BR-20 reconnaissance aircraft up to have a look at the Valletta Harbour, see what was there. And they'd send it over with a pack of these Mackies who all flew along in tight formation and scattered in all directions if we appeared. Once or twice, they'd do a strafing run, two of them or four of them would just whiz across the airfield, firing at anything wild, and they seldom hit anything at all of any consequence. One day the Germans, they did do a low-ranging run. The Munchenberg, the Luftwaffe ace, was leading the Germans at that time in Sicily. And they did come along and clobber the Hurricanes out on the line. And the Italians tried it once or twice, but they missed. And then they re-equipped them with the Mackie 202, which was rather a different kettle of fish. They put a Daimler-Benz engine, the same engine that the 109F had got. It was a good engine. And that did make a huge difference to the performance of the Mackie 200. But there again, although they got this quite superior aircraft, they didn't exploit their position to any extent. They would stay in dogfight a bit longer, but not for long. And they did come across once or twice in the early morning doing strafing runs. But it didn't amount to an awful lot. In the meantime, we were enjoying life quite considerably. We'd go swimming down on the rocks at Slema with the Policino girls. These were a grandee family who lived up in Mdina, which was the picturesque cathedral town that overlooks Tacali Airfield. Wonderful, spectacular place. And there's a family there called Policino. There was Sir Philip Policino, who it was always said, sat up in the top room of his house with his radio transmitter going, tapping out all day long with information about what we were doing in Malta. So the story went, it's probably totally untrue. It was said this was the case. And in return, he allowed us to take his daughters out. And there were six of them. And they're all beautiful. Did I say six? No, I meant four. There were four of them, that's right. Yes, Tom Neal did a very strong line with Patsy. She was the beauty. So life was good, and there were cinemas and lots of bars and cabarets, and a private war with the Italians, which was all going to come to an end rather drastically just before Christmas 41.
Can I ask you about the airfield, the kind of layout, and because you mentioned the dispersal area was a tent. Could you give me a picture of the airfield at that time when you arrived?
Yes. It was roughly circular in shape. A Hurricane could get in and out with difficulty. As I would think it was probably about 1,200 yards across, thereabouts. It wasn't a large, it was adequate for Hurricanes. The Italians, it was used very much by the Italian airline before the war, Alitalia. It was the sole airfield for that airline. The facilities there was one building which had been the airline company's businesses, which had become station headquarters. There were no hangars. There weren't many bays at that time. Later on in the battle, they went barmy and put sandbag bays everywhere for aircraft standing. But the fact is, although we were involved in this situation, we didn't seem to have any particular urgency about strengthening up the defences, like building blast-proof shelters and bays. There were one or two areas where original stone walls had been put up sometime or other by farmers, and sometimes we'd make use of those to accommodate an aeroplane. But there was no real effort to construct anything that would give protection to the aircraft, simply because although they had their troubles when the Luftwaffe were down there, there didn't seem much urgency as far as dealing with the Italian war was concerned. It seemed to be going along quite happily. Warburton, the famous, hello there, the famous reconnaissance pilot, would go out most days and seek out convoys going across to Rommel in North Africa. And the Blenheims, of which there are two or maybe three squadrons based at Lucca, and they would go off and attack these convoys with terrible losses. Out of six, it was quite common for four to come back, or even three. They took an awful beating. Squadrons of Wellingtons would come out, base themselves at Lucca, and carry out raids on the North African ports in particular. Sometimes they'd go to Sicily and go for Palermo or Cassino, Messina, or to the North African ports, Tripoli, Benghazi. So the offensive operation was the big one. And Hugh Lloyd, the ABC, was very, very much concerned with obtaining a maximum effort from his bomber forces, although he did have losses, heavy losses. But as far as the fighters were concerned, we were left to get on with our own devices, which we did. We had a few offensive operations. One in particular was to carry out a bombing attack on Gela, which is the Italian airfield on the south coast. And there were two or three squadrons of Mackie 200, 202s there. And we had a new wing commander posted, a Canadian, Brown. He was posted in Tricali as wing commander flying of the two squadrons. And he talked Hugh Pugh into authorizing a bombing raid on Taylor. So they armed us up with bomb racks, and they put these little 20-pound bombs, eight of them, under the wings. And we went off in first light one morning. I think it was two squadrons went. And we arrived over Jailer, and we all did our dive bombing bit, pressed the button, and let all these little bombs go off there. Because didn't go any good. Made a lot of noise, I'm sure. Probably frightened the Italians to death. They were all dead by then. And so that was quite good. Except, unfortunately, the wing commander did one strafing run. He dropped his bombs, did a strafing run, turned around and came back for a second run, got hit right over the middle of the airfield, blew up. So that was our brand new wing commander flying. And we weren't organized into doing another operation of that kind. What we did do, though, We did go over at night, again with these little bombs. More of a nuisance value than anything. And we just poodled over at night and let these bombs go, what we could see on the ground, and hope that it was of some military value and not some poor former farmer's house.